mean honorable members. Good morning to the officials from the Department of Basic Education. Good morning to the staff members. I am going to open the meeting officially, and I am not sure if we know each other, so I will give the opportunity for members and members from the Department of Education and everybody else that is inside the room to introduce him or herself. I am Sugiswa Ranto, a delegate from Eastern Cape, a acting chairperson of this session for today. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Pinkin Nobe from Gauteng. Thank you.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Michael de Villiers. I'm also a member of the Select Committee, and I'm representing the Western Cape here. But I just want to address something with Chairperson now currently in the chair. This morning we elected another member, Honorable Nube, as the chairperson of the meeting. Now there's another one in the chair. Just for the correction and for the legality of it, can we just make a change like that, chairperson? Thank you.
I propose. Okay. Sorry, we will formally propose it. The secretary will do the formal
nominations for the acting chairperson.
But the time is quick. I hereby nominate Member Ranto to act as a chairperson of this session. Thank you.
And second, that's
okay. I second. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sivile. Mr. Ranto, chair your committee.
Can we carry on with the introduction, please?
Okay, my name is Thabo Makunyan. I'm a member of the committee from Limpopo.
I asked everybody else to introduce him or herself in this.
Very good morning. My name is Thabo Mthethwa, a college advisor for the committee.
Good morning, members. Linda Stoffel is my name, a researcher for the committee.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson and Honorable Members. Thank you, Honorable Chairperson and Members. My name is Mirwan Mahadalia, I'm from the Office of the Director General of Basic Education.
Good morning, Honorable Chairperson, Honorable Members, colleagues. My name is Faith Kuhlman. I'm Chief Director for Care and Supporting Schools at the Department of Basic Education.
Good morning, Honorable Chair, Honorable Members and Colleagues. I'm Shemaine Mana from the Department of Basic Education. I'm the Acting Chief Director for Social Inclusion and Partnerships in Education.
Thank you, everybody. Udlanga has not introduced himself.
My name is Mzuyanda Langa. I'm the secretary for the committee.
Would you, can you come in with the proposal?
Morning, members. I'm Kulan Dema, monitor PLG.
Thank you, everybody has introduced him or herself. we will give over to the department for the presentation. There is a small change in the presentation. We are receiving a new document that does not have major changes. It's only small changes that are from the original document that was sent. So, thank you. Over to the department for the presentation.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson, Honorable members. We would like to, first of all, thank sincerely the SILEP Committee on Education and Recreation for inviting the department to come and make this presentation to you this morning. We would like to also, at the outset, really extend our apology for the Director General, as well as our DDG, Ms. Ndebeles, and DG, Obis O'Brien, who were not able to come. And I believe that from an apology has been difficult, but really would like to start by saying so. We would like also to just recognize and thank the committee for identifying this really important topics, you know, of school health as well as school safety, to be part of your program so that you can receive this presentation from us, because we feel that they are really critical social issues that require all our collective efforts, and that it is important that as a department we come and indicate to you how it is that we are responding to them at the present moment and some of the successes that we have in, but more importantly the challenges and how working together with you we can be able to identify them early and work with other stakeholders to address them fully within the basic education sector. Just as a form of background, we have divided the presentation between myself and Dr. Mana. We want to first just to make sure that members understand how we are structured as a department, that we come from the social mobilization and support services branch of the department. There are a number of other branches, you know, there's a unit or whole branch that deals with issues of teachers, there's one that deals with planning, we also have the branch headed by DDG that deals with administration in the office of the CFO, as well as one that deals with curriculum issues specifically. Ours really is meant to be the branch that is meant to support and create an enabling environment for optimum teaching and learning. So our mandate is that we are meant to mobilize all sectors in support of basic education so that we can use schools as vehicles for promoting learner access to a range of public services such as health, poverty alleviation, social cohesion, sport and culture. I would like to remind members that when the new administration came in 2009, the Department of Basic Education identified four critical interventions that really have been our marching orders and the mantra that we work to. And we frame those as CAWI, like our minister has called them. It's mainly around strengthening the curriculum delivery, strengthening assessment through the use of the national senior certificate as well as the annual national assessment, making sure that workbooks that the W are available and are being used, and then lastly the issues of infrastructure. But underpinning all that is S, and that is the unit that we come from, that says that all those four things can never happen unless there's a supporting and enabling school environment, and that's the branch and the mandate from which we come. I will then, member and chairperson, ask Dr. Mana, who's the acting chief director for social inclusion and partnership, to take the committee through the school safety presentation, whereafter I will then follow and talk about the integrated school health program. But really, chairperson and members, we want to really express our thanks for the opportunity that you've afforded us. I'd like to hand over to Dr. Mana if that's appropriate.
Thanks, Dr. Faye. Next. Yes. And thank you for the apologies that you presented in front of us. I would like, before Dr. Mana starts, the secretary to give us apologies from the department and everybody else who is not here, who is supposed to be here.
I did receive the apology from all members of our committees, Ms. Khasmin, Ms. Mushroti, and the chairperson of the committee. Also, the apologies from the Department of Basic Education, my counterpart, and the only apology. Today, they are cabinet meeting, and ministers are part of those meetings. So those are the apologies that I have.
Thanks. Mr. Dama. Then Dr. Mann, you can take over.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. Once again, I'd like to also express our gratitude for having the privilege of presenting to the Select Committee on Education and Recreation. Before I begin with the presentation, I just want to give you a brief overview of what the Chief Director of Social Inclusion and Partnership does. The Social Inclusion and Partnership Chief Directorate consists of four directorates. The first dealing with social cohesion and equity issues, in particular gender equity, and looking specifically at human rights. The next directorate deals with sports and enrichment, specifically at sports league, school sports, and physical education, as well as cultural issues like the Coral Life Stepford, etc. The third directorate deals with school safety, and the school safety directorate is fairly new, having been established a year and a half ago. Currently, the focus of the school safety directorate, it has been on specifically on school violence, but we're looking to broadening it to bring in all the other issues of violence. The fourth directorate is the partnership directorate, and that directorate has been formed to work with partners across, whether they are business, corporate, NGOs, interested parties and entities. And that particular directorate facilitates partnerships so that they can support the priorities of the Department of Education. Okay, in terms of school safety, the overview of my presentation, I will start off with the guiding principles, move on to violence in schools, talk about the current evidence on school violence and the key findings, and then I will talk specifically on how the Department of Basic Education responds to school safety, and of course the conclusion. Okay, in terms of the guiding principles, what underpins our strategy and our vision for school safety? It is, of course, underpinned by the National Development Plan, which in the diagnostic analysis pointed out that there were several issues around safety, and in the NDP makes particular recommendations for safety. And of course, the blueprint for the Department of Basic Education is Action Plan 2014 towards Vision 2025. I must apologize for that. This particular plan has laid out 27 goals for the department, and it is directly aligned to outcome one, the delivery of quality basic education, but also to broader mandates within the government of South Africa. We as the safety directorate, we are involved in the following three goals. Goal 10, which is to ensure learners remain effectively enrolled in school up to 15 years. And this speaks specifically of retention. Because in a school where there is violence, where a child feels unsafe, they're not going to want to come to school. So that is why this particular goal is related to school safety. The next goal, goal 22, improve parent and community participation in the governance of schools. And we believe that school safety is not just an issue for schools alone, that actually you need to bring in the community to support the schools to ensure that it's safe. Because the violence doesn't happen in the schools, it's actually brought in from the community into the schools. So that's the reason for goal 22. And then goal 24, to ensure that the environment of every school inspires learners to want to come to school and learn and teachers to teach. Now, we all know in a school where there are high levels of violence, learners don't want to come to school, and that very little teaching and learning occurs. So in terms of the vision and the mission for the school safety directive, we are directed by these goals in the action plan. Okay, let's look at violence in schools. Perception and reality. I mean, from that cartoon, you can see that the perception is that there is, you know, violence all over and it's completely out of control. The fact that the teacher asked the children, what would you want to grow up, what would you want to be when you grow up, and the child says, alive. So it just gives you the kind of fear factor in terms of violence. However, let's look at what the current evidence is telling us on violence in schools. Okay, as a department, we leverage on existing data and research, and we work closely with different organizations and institutions in order to be able to use their data and to learn from their different methods and methodologies. We work with the South African Council of Educators, specifically looking at issues of safety in terms of learner-teacher abuse, etc. We work very closely with the Center for Justice and Crime Prevention, working closely in terms of their research, and the South African Human Rights Commission, the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development, the Department of Social Development, etc. Now, I just want to point out that in terms of us receiving reports from the provinces, which we do, about incidents of violence, there is the integrity of that kind of data is often in doubt. And as a result, we rely on external partners to be able to give us proper evidence-based data that has integrity and rigor and is valid. But we still collect data from the provinces, and we're trying to find a far more innovative way to be able to get proper data from the provinces. In 2008, the Center for Justice and Crime Prevention conducted the first baseline study on school violence. And then 4 years later, it conducted a follow-up study in 2012. The 2008 study found that 22% of the secondary school learners surveyed had succumbed to some form of violence in the 12 months preceding the study. Okay? All right, and this is what the 2008 study reveals. It reveals that most schools have similar safety and security challenges, which could be grouped into the following: physical infrastructure and equipment, safety and security, management and governance, and partnership. And these are important because these are issues that we have referred to infrastructure, etc., to our infrastructure department. The second National School Violence Study, which occurred in 2012, revealed that although violence is still high, it has remained constant at 22.2% in 2012. So the perception is that our schools are burning, but the evidence is telling us that it has remained constant and it has increased. But this in no way means that we must relax, because 20%, 22% is still a very high percentage, and we need to bring it down. But it also gives us an opportunity to see what is working in the 80% of the schools. How can we ensure that those schools don't reach levels of violence? So it gives us that kind of information. It provided data on the sites of violence, the hotspots, and the gendered nature of sexual assault. This allows for targeted interventions and responses. Okay, the key findings for the 2012 National School Violence Study. The sample comprised of 5,939 learners, 121 principals, and 239 educators. In total, more than a fifth of learners had experienced violence in school. 12.2 had been threatened with violence by someone in school. 6.3 had been assaulted. 4.7% had been sexually assaulted or raped. 4.5% had been robbed at school. 20% of scholars had experienced some form of cyberbullying violence in the past year. Violence at school was often not a once-off encounter. Violence was not limited to incidents between learners. The classroom is the primary site of victimization. Educators were also victims of verbal abuse, 52.1%, physical violence, 12.4%, and sexual violence, 3.3%, perpetrated by learners. So we can see that the study is showing that we do have a serious issue on our hands. Okay, so let's look at the perpetrators of violence. Who are the ones? Okay, in terms of school teachers, we see that they are responsible for 25% of the assault. Okay, and that's where their highest perpetration happens. School pupils, they are 90.3% responsible for threats in the school, 69.8% for assault, 90.8% for sexual assault, 86.0% for robbery, and 91.3% for theft. So we can see that most of our work and intervention needs to go into our school pupils, because the statistics are telling us that they are the majority perpetrators. Family members, we see that the figures are not more than 3%. So, I mean, it doesn't mean that this is about in school. But remember, there are empirical findings that tell us that violence happens in the family, and that is why the child is violent at the school. So that, this is just for the school. Other persons of authority, we can see again the highest being 3%. Persons out from outside of the school who's actually inside the school, the levels are not very significant. And even gang members, the levels are not significant because we're looking at inside the school. The gang warfare happens outside the school, near the school gate. Okay, let's look at the location of violence. We find that classrooms tend to be the area where most of the violence occurs. Okay, threats 44%, assault 51%, sexual assault 54%, robbery 60%, and theft 91.5%. So we can see that the classroom is where we need to spend a lot of our energy to change the kind of dynamic there. And then one needs to consider, what is the teacher doing when these statistics are so high? The school gate, again, the statistics are relatively low. The playing field is quite high as well in terms of threats on the playing field. We see that even assaults are fairly high, and sexual assaults, 13% on the playing field and 14% on the playing field. So another red flag for us in terms of intervention. The corridors are fairly, they also show some high figures, because we think if it's more than 5%, it's a red flag. We've got 11% threats, but an important thing is the corridor seems to be an unsafe place in terms of gender, because we see 11.4% of sexual assault happen in the corridors of the school. So it means that we need to ensure that these are being monitored and that learners feel safe. Another is the school toilet. Again, if you go to sexual assault, you see 12.5% of sexual assault happens in the school toilet. Now, that's obviously an area that we need to sort out and work. In the open ground, threats are 13.5%. In the other open grounds, for example, if there is an open ground near the school, a park near the school, this is where the threats happen. Assaults happen there as well, which is fairly high, and sexual assaults. In the halls themselves, there isn't much, it isn't that high, and of course the principal's office is not that high either. Okay, so how do we respond as the Department of Basic Education to violence in schools? Okay, our response is underpinned by the following. School violence is undergirded by a myriad of individual school, family, and broader community level risk factors that coalesce to create vulnerabilities for violence, meaning that we cannot just look at violence alone in the classroom. We have to look at the surrounding risk factors as well, the community, the family, you know, and also try to understand, because where there is a safe community, there will be no violence in the school. So we need to look at it broadly and not to have a tunnel vision response to school violence. Any attempt to curb school violence needs to extend beyond the school itself. Parental and community support, including prevention and early intervention, are the most reliable and cost-effective ways to support school safety. Now, this is extremely important, is that if we can get this right, I mean, currently the stats are showing us that, yes, 22% is high, but we have something like 80% where there isn't high levels of violence. So how do we keep it at that level? What preventative measures must we have to be able to prevent those good schools going into violence? Okay, we use the ecological model to address violence in schools, starting off with the individual, the relationship, looking at family, peers, etc., the community, and of course the broader society. Now, I'm not going to discuss all of this. I just want to point out that, you know, in terms of our history, we are living in a violent society. We cannot pretend that we are not. We come from the violence of apartheid, and we haven't really had, as a country, we've transformed to a particular level, but we haven't been able to change the way we address issues of violence. Because during apartheid, in order to make a statement, we would go on marches. Some of them became violent marches. So I think, you know, that kind of culture, the remnants of that, is still very much in young people and communities today. And plus there is a lot of frustration, etc. So one of the easiest things to do is to resort to violence rather than negotiate and do some conflict resolution. Okay, so what have we done as the Department of Basic Education? School safety and the prevention of crime is a shared mandate, hence the DBE collaborates with other relevant departments. Now, we work with the Department of Social Development and the Department of Health, but what I'm going to speak about today is about a very good program we have, and that is the DBE. The DBE and SAPS have signed a protocol to reduce crime and violence in schools and in communities. Now, the strategic objective of this protocol is to create safe, caring, and child-friendly schools and address incidents of crime and violence in a holistic and integrated manner. We do not want the police to be patrolling the schools because, you know, then unfortunately crime goes underground and it becomes more pervasive. What we want is that for schools to have a resource. As soon as we have a linked 14,000 schools to police stations so that the police can provide the kind of resource should there be any kind of problem, but also work with the school governing bodies, giving them ideas on crime prevention, etc. So it's not about the police patrolling the schools. It's about how they play a resource and a mentoring role. Okay, the focus of the protocol is to strengthen school safe committee in addressing crime. So once the protocol was signed and the schools are linked, then they form a school safety committee, which is made up of the school governing body, a teacher or the principal, and a member of the police station that's been linked. Okay, and then they form the mini committee to implement the programs of the protocol. To assume an active role as a member of the Safe School Committee, to link all schools to local police stations, to raise awareness amongst children and young learners regarding crime and violence and its impact on individuals, families, and education. The police knows where the hotspots are in that community in terms of crime. So it is the role of the School Safety Committee then to inform the young people that you don't walk there at that time, because these are the things that could happen to you. That in order for your safety, this is how you should take care of yourself. Walk in groups. Don't walk alone late at night. Don't carry your cell phone for everybody else to see. So it's about teaching them those kind of protective measures. To mobilize communities to take ownership of the schools. Now, this is extremely important because a school cannot be safe if the community is not safe. And SAPS has their community police forum. And it's about how the community police forum comes together with the schools to create a kind of safety net around the school. Because for too long we've been seeing in our schools the doors being stolen. When you put computers, they're stealing the computers. And their children go to these schools. Well, once we put in the community safety forums, you find that these things stop because the communities know who these people are and they stop them. So this is what we are doing, making education a societal issue. We're making it a part of the community ownership. And to encourage the establishment of reporting systems at school. Honorable members, this is an area that obviously needs a lot of work. It's still in its infancy form for us in terms of getting reporting. There's a lot of under-reporting, and we need to find some kind of mechanism to work with SAPS. Because, you know, if a child's raped, they don't want to go to the police station. So we need to find ways in which that we put in protocols and systems that honors the child but also doesn't let the perpetrator get away. Mm. So that is something we are working with. And it's part also of the health promotion directive that looks at sexual reproductive health and life skills. And then, of course, to implement school-based crime prevention programs in collaboration with provincial, district, local officials responsible for school safety. Okay, I've spoken about the, I'm not going to spend too much time on this because I've spoken about it. Okay, other programs that we have. A major pillar of the school safety program is the DBE SAPS protocol. But we have other programs that we run, okay? We know that bullying is a precursor to more violent behavior. Okay, once a child bullies, I mean, you know, they're going to progress into becoming more violent. So it must be stopped in the bud, right there, nipped off in the bud. But that hasn't been happening because teachers don't know how to do it. They can't even recognize bullying. They think it's part of boys being boys, or they're just teasing. And they don't realize the detrimental effect that this kind of behavior has on young people. So what we have done is that we have developed training manuals for bullying, to address bullying, and we have trained something like 2,500 master trainers across the country on the bullying. I'm sure my colleague there will give you some of the information and the handbooks, etc., that we've developed. And then the provinces are expected to take this down to the level of the district and the schools. But we know the challenge there. Many times they'll have the training and then they don't cascade it down. So that is where our challenge is. And that is where we look to the HODs of the provinces and the school governing bodies to be able to be the monitoring, to play that monitoring role. We also have developed leaflets for parents, on tips for parents in schools to stop bullying. We've got school safety. So we have a lot of information going out to parents in terms of violence. I'm going to read all of this. In terms of cyberbullying, I spoke about bullying and I said that it is a precursor. But what we see an increase in South Africa is cyberbullying. Because as we're becoming more and more technologically advanced, our kids are taking their cell phones and they're bullying other children via the cell phone. And these are really, really, crazy things. Also, the whole thing in terms of pornography, you know, thinking it's innocent, and that's my boyfriend, so I took a picture of myself in my bikini or my underwear, and I sent it to him, and then he makes it go viral. Now, those kinds of things, you know, these kids are young, they see it on TV, they think it's cool, but they don't realize what kind of impact it has on them. So we've also developed a pamphlet on bullying, or cyberbullying. We also have an e-learning strategy that assists parents in terms of what they are to look out for. But these are all included in the life orientation curriculum. Okay, as part of the safety directive, we also work with health promotion in terms of dealing with the issues of drugs and substance abuse. We know that, you know, drugs are gateways to more violent and harder drug taking and violent behavior. And of course, you know, it makes a community vulnerable. So we work together with them. We have a monitoring framework, but it hasn't been working so well because we've been using the SA STAM system. where schools then load into their, however, in terms of populating it, it's just about 30% of schools that are populating it. So we have to find something far more innovative. And you know, sometimes we want all the details from the entire country, all 12 million learners and 26,000 schools. But sometimes it would be important to just do a small random sampling so that you get a feel of what is happening. And that is the way we are going as well. We're still carrying on with SSMs and hoping that it will eventually be populated to 60% so that we can use it to generalize. But if it's been populated to 30%, you can't actually generalize with that kind of information. Okay? And of course, what we are doing is that we are collecting those pockets of excellence, those strategies that have worked in the provinces, and we are sort of creating, we will create a portal for evidence-based programs. Now also, how do we deal with school safety issues across the education ambit? We also work with curriculum and teacher development. Remember, Dr. Kumalo pointed out that we are an enabling environment. We create an enabling environment and we support. So we are not directly involved in curriculum, but as part of the life orientation where most of our issues lie, we develop material for life orientation curriculum. We've developed the Bill of Responsibilities and the teacher training manual so that they were able to teach about rights and responsibilities. So that a learner knows, yes, I have the right to protest, but I have the right to protest responsibly. I must not go and burn the library or the school or beat somebody else up. So that is how we are supporting curriculum in terms of the materials we've developed. We've also developed a values in action manual for school governing bodies and for RCL. You know, the SGBs are the gatekeepers to many of the policies in the schools, and we want to help them to understand how they have to honor the constitution of the country when they are making decisions on language, on teenage pregnancy, etc. We have developed for gender-based violence an advocacy tool, a booklet called Speak Out Against Abuse, that gives young people information on what they should do, tells them that it is wrong for a teacher to have a relationship with them, gives them all the information and contact numbers that they can go to. So this also provides them with that. We also use our Sports for Development program to teach about school safety, to teach about values. We work with the Health Promotion Directors on their peer education and life skills program. And of course, we have partnerships with very good organizations. Some might have a research strength, others have a mobilization strength. So we have a whole menu of partners that we use to support us. Okay, in conclusion, addressing violence cannot be solely addressed at one level, and I think that I've been quite clear about that, that we cannot only look at it at the level of the school. Okay, the two studies, the 2008 and the 2012 National School Violence Study, highlighted the extent to which family and community factors intersect with levels of violence occurring at schools. So it is important now for us to ensure we bring community and we bring family into our strategies to curb school violence. And we know that school violence has deep societal origins, and that the same community and a broader societal environment are actually prerequisites for school safety. Okay, I will stop there. Thank you, Honorable Chairperson.
Thank you. Thanks. Honorable members, we will reserve our questions next for the next presentation. After the next presentation, then we'll be able to ask questions for both presentations.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. The integrated school health program in the department is housed within the chief directorate that I'm responsible for, which is the care and supportive schools chief directorate.
In its former configuration, it used to be called Health and Education. Excuse me. But we then realized that, you know, sometimes when we speak about health, then people reduce the conversation to health services. And that in fact what we need to do is to look more holistically at the child's well-being, including issues of psychosocial support and others that we now are integrating into our work. The Chief Directorate, therefore, is responsible for promoting the health of learners and educators, as well as creating them that caring and supportive school environment. There are three directorates that are under this Chief Directorate. One is the National School Nutrition Program, and as members know, this is really a huge, huge program that is reaching over 9 million learners every single day. We also have the Health Promotion Directorate, within which the Integrated School Health Program is housed. That directorate also deals with issues of the HIV and AIDS program within the schooling environment. We manage also the drug prevention and alcohol prevention program. We have peer education programs housed in there. And like I said, another big one, which is really the topic for today's discussion, is the Integrated School Health Program. We have a baby of the Chief Directorate. It's a directorate that we call psychosocial support. It really has been in our organogram for only 1 year because we want to make sure that we grow that area of work, because we realize that there are many psychological and social issues that impact negatively on teaching and learning, and so we're beginning to put down the mandate for education with respect to this and begin to resource it better within the system. Specifically, with respect to the Integrated School Health Program, that is the outline of my presentation. I think it's important to start this presentation by indicating that the reciprocal relationship between education and health has been well documented and researched. What we know is that education in itself is a key determinant of better health outcomes. That people who have education have the better chance of having accurate knowledge, but also the requisite skills to be able to take appropriate and healthy decisions around their health, and generally would tend to be in a better healthy situation than those who don't. But on the other hand, what we also know is that if there are health barriers that exist and are not identified, aided, and addressed, they can actually themselves be a barrier to be able to access optimum teaching and learning. And therefore, we then, in the schooling environment, will not be able to achieve the optimal outcomes that we require. Now, it's important that we also indicate to members that, you know, many of us who are of a certain generation remember the time when nurses used to come quite regularly to schools, and we would get, you know, our vaccinations and other services. But we know that these are services that have really depleted over the past 10 years or so. The Department of Health developed a school health program, or policy in fact they called it, in 2003. That has really not been implemented as well as it should have been. And so in June of 2009, which is really the history of how we've gotten to the current school health program, our minister, Minister Motsekga, in her budget vote speech in Parliament, indicated and announced to the nation that she had held a discussion and in fact reached agreement with the Minister of Health that starting in 2010, we are going to bring back school health screening so that children can have screening for their vision, for their hearing, and for their teeth. And so we had to start working very, very quickly to make sure that the system was ready to implement this very clear mandate. So in 2009, we then set up a joint task team between ourselves, the education, and health to start looking at how we can do this. But given the very clear resource constraints that we found, namely that in the country nationally, we had approximately 500 school health nurses only to deal with 12 million school children in the system, it was clear that this mandate was never going to be implemented fully. So we agreed that we're going to implement what we call school health weeks
in March and October, wherein all the resources within the primary healthcare system could then target specifically schools and pull all the nurses as far as possible so that they outreach and go into schools. And we started doing this in 2010. And this really was the beginning of this much more improved approach towards school health. As we were doing this, Minister Motsepe also said that, you know, while she appreciated the efforts of reaching grade one learners, she was particularly worried about learners that were repeating grades. And so she said it's important that we make sure that we bring them into the fold. We also needed to make sure that parents and educators were able to refer learners. So in addition to the grade ones, those must also be put into the fold. But what she really put on the table for us was that we need to make sure that over time we can provide these services incrementally to all children in the school system. Because, you know, whilst the fact that you are not in grade one anymore does not mean that you had the opportunity to have your health barriers identified and addressed. And so we needed to make sure that health services were available to every single learner within the system. And so those were the mandates that we took on board to then develop the integrated school health program, whose mandate really is to make sure that over time we can incrementally provide services to all learners within the schooling system. We developed a task team that not only just included health and education, but we brought back or brought in the Department of Social Development because of the psychosocial needs that I've spoken about. Mm-hmm. And we are led, and all the work that is happening within that joint task team is led by the Deputy Director General of Education and Health. And we have recently gotten confirmation and participation for the DDG from Social Development, which has really moved our process forward in a very major way. We also have participation of NGOs as well as development partners in the task team, because they are more present on the ground, but we wanted to bring in development partners so that they can do two things for us. One, to guide us in terms of the latest and the newest evidence of where we should go, but secondly, to also assist us with funding some of the work. And I will talk to the issue of funding, because really it is becoming a little bit of a challenge to how fast and how fully we can implement the program. We are really blessed in that we have very, very strong political commitment and leadership for school health services from the highest office in the country. The president, when he launched the integrated school health program in October of 2012, actually said that this program is a revolution and that it has the potential to take the trajectory of our country into a higher level. Because through the integrated school health program, we can address the two most important priorities of this administration, the health status of learners, as well as the educational outcomes, which are really number one. And we took that mandate and we have been able to use that commitment to be able to garner support for the work that we've done since. Next month, in March of 2014, we are going to launch, as part of this program, the Minister of Health and Basic Education are going to launch the Human Papilloma Virus Vaccination Program for girls, and I'll speak a little bit about this later on. But for us, it really shows again, yes, the topmost political commitment and leadership for this work. Since 2010, the President has always spoken in the State of the Nation address about school health services. And yet again, we are using that to make sure that we live up to his expectation and the mandate that he's thrown out to the nation. Now, we have some achievement, and I would like to briefly speak to the committee about what are some of the things that we have managed to do. I've indicated that we've got this task team that is at national level, and that is providing support to provinces. We've also developed an intergovernmental protocol between the three departments that really will specify clearly what the roles and responsibilities are and the expectations from all the participants. We've developed guidelines for school governing bodies, in particular for them to consult with parents on the integrated school health program, because we feel that the participation of parents
and the contribution of parents and community is really, really key for this program to have success. At a provincial level, those structures are replicated, and in those provinces they are fully functional, and we are working very, very hard to make sure that we bring in some of the other provinces that are not yet at the levels we would want on board as soon as possible. And all provinces are developing joint implementation plans around this work. And for us, that is really, really key. Because what it does is that it begins to get a number of government departments to work together towards a common vision and have the same indicators of success as well as the targets in each of their annual assessment plans. And I don't think that there are many programs that are implemented currently that can say they are doing that. You know, there's a very much a silo approach generally in government, but for this program, we need all of us, and we have begun to show that it's actually possible to do, to bring in several parties to work together, particularly as government, to do this work. We hold regular interprovincial meetings where we bring social development, health, and education together at the provinces, at the national level, to talk about the successes, progress, challenges, but also to plan how to strengthen the programs moving forward. We do quite a lot of school level monitoring and support, and use all avenues in education when we are in schools to also check up on the school health program and find out if it is happening. And the results of that have been quite mixed. In some areas it's working very well, in others not as well as it should. And we are working very hard to make sure that we bridge the gap in that respect. We are asking that these structures also exist at district level, but as education, I think it's important to also highlight that through the support of the European Union, we have been able to procure equipment that has been provided to schools and has been put on the asset register for schools. So this equipment resides within the school environment, so that when the health professionals are available, they can come and find that the equipment is ready. Because you will see, when I talk about challenges, some of the challenges is really about the availability of equipment. Because the equipment has to be transported from the clinic. They must take it with them and then bring it to the school. And sometimes the equipment is more needed at the clinic, and so they can't take it away. So we feel that this investment is really, really an important one, that the schools can be the owners of this equipment, so that nurses from health, but also other partners, other professionals that are able and are competent, can come in and assist to make sure that health services are provided much more wholly and fully to learners within our schools. Even the provinces themselves have been able to use the HIV and AIDS Life Skills Education Program grant to begin to supplement some of this equipment that we need. Importantly, members, we want to share that the Department of Health has also purchased state-of-the-art mobiles for the 11th National Health Insurance pilot district site. And these are really, really, really wonderful. I want to go quickly to the slides that show some of these materials, the mobiles that are provided. There are three sets of mobiles. One mobile is a routine primary healthcare mobile that the nurses would use to provide services. The other one, which is what I'm showing here, is an eye care mobile that would have an optometrist come. So at the school or at the site, you are immediately at the same time able to do, have a proper full eye examination, have a diagnosis in terms of the prescription that you need, and have the spectacles dispensed on the ground at the same time without having to be referred to go somewhere else. On the right-hand side of the slide is showing the couch there that's inside the dental unit, where in fact you can also have fissure sealants done. You can also have extractions performed also on the grounds of the school without having to have referrals. This is the big truck that is the primary health care mobile that I spoke about. And what is inside the mobile as well is that operation chair that you can use to do pap smear examinations for women, but also you can also be able to do male medical circumcision on the spot without needing referrals. So this huge investment in the equipment has really been a success of the work that you've done so far. What you've also done is that you've targeted the groupings, you know, so it's not about just going in and doing everybody. We've decided based on the evidence but also on the capacity that we are going to target grade 1, 4, 8 and 10 learners to receive the services. In addition, like I've indicated, learners in any other grade who are repeating class and learners in special schools would also be brought in to receive services, but also those that are referred by their parents and educators additionally. And this is just some of the thinking of why we're targeting those particular grades, and we can always come back to that for discussion later, Chairperson, if you see the need. We've agreed also and defined a specific health services package, and there are four parts to the package. One is the screening, and I've already spoken about that screening. In addition to vision, hearing, nutritional status, as well as teeth, we're also screening for TB, because as members might know, TB is a really, really serious problem in our country. And this we do through asking really very simple four questions of learners, and then they can then be targeted for much more intensive diagnosis, whether they do have TB or not. Secondly, there's a provision of on-site services such as immunization as well as treatment of minor ailments. Thirdly, we're providing a large component of health education through the health promoters, because we feel that that is really the purview and the critical advantage that education has, to be able to provide children with knowledge so that they can take control of their own lives and be able to make informed decisions and promote, in fact, their health for forever, for lifelong. And fourthly, we also conduct an environmental assessment, just looking, you know, at the health and safety aspects within the environment and making sure that we do that. Critically, for older learners, there's a package of sexual and reproductive health services. This package is provided only by professional nurses in a confidential and a private one-on-one consultation. It's not a must. And it includes voluntary HIV counseling and testing. It includes the provision of contraception, including condoms, what we call G1 protection. There's also screening for sexually transmitted infections as well as pregnancy. We also provide education on male medical circumcision. And no circumcision take place at the school premises during school hours. We've agreed with the Department of Health that we provide only education and that if there's procedures to be done, they must either be done during school holidays or they must be referred to health facilities. So that's the how we deal with the issue. In terms of human and other resources, there are dedicated coordinators in the Department of Health, and in the Department of Basic Education, we've identified focal point persons to lead our work on this front. They are not dedicated only to this program, which sometimes poses a challenge, and it's one of the recommendations that we put forward to the department, that we need dedicated staff, because if they are busy with other needs, you know, as we're incrementally providing services to all learners, we need even more capacity, and this is proving to be somewhat of a challenge at the moment. Some provinces, you know, they have DSD on board, but we're working hard to deal with it. In terms of school health teams, the school health team has two nurses. There's a registered nurse who's the lead of the team. We also have an enrolled nursing assistant that assists her. We have an oral hygienist to take care of the dental needs, as well as a health promoter to deal with the education agenda that we've spoken about. I must indicate that we have increased the number of teams over the past 2 years. But they
sorry,
are not...
Sorry, ma'am, you are left off. 1 minute.
Okay, I'll do that. Thank you. I think I'll go to the critical ones. We've spoken about the numbers. These are the number of school health teams that we have available, and indicating that they are not enough. We need a whole bunch more. We similarly, you know, developed advocacy material that targets particularly parents, learners, and teachers, so that they really understand what their role is and what the expectation is, and we're making sure that we have those available out in schools very much, as much as we can. And critically, this includes, you know, alcohol and drug abuse. is a component of this group. It's important to indicate that participation is voluntary. What we're asking for, we want active parental consent for their children to participate and receive services. But for learners that are 12 years and older, in line with the Children's Act, we're asking that the children themselves assent to receiving the services as well. And we really encourage that parents that accompany their children as far as is possible. And in fact, our experience, you know, is that parents are doing that. So when we were in Limpopo a year ago, we found many parents coming in with their children, and we think this is important because they are able to provide the medical history that educators might not have, which might be critical for finding a diagnosis. In terms of the reach of the program, these are the number of learners that we've reached since 2010, and just to note that the 2013 figures exclude quarter four, which is the current one. And as members will see, for each year, we have outstripped what our targets that we set for ourselves are. However, we do want to make the point that whilst we have overshot the target, we are nowhere meeting and seeing all the children that we need to. So 750,000 is wonderful, but against the 12 million target, it's nowhere near where the country needs to be. I've spoken about equipment. I do want to talk about the issues of data. Currently, the Department of Health are the custodians of our data, and they are using the District Health Information System. And we're having some challenges in getting the data to education in time and accurately. The AG has raised this with us very much because the Auditor General expects that they want the name and ID number of who receives the services. Mm-hmm. And because health is a confidential and private matter, we've been told that that is something that we can't do. So we've relied on that. But the lack of funding and chairperson inclusion, I want to indicate that in the Department of Basic Education, the directorate that is responsible for this work receives no voted funds for all the work that we're doing. The total budget for the directorate is 450,000 rands, which is not enough. We've asked for EU funding to continue some of our work. We're still waiting for an answer, but moving forward, we have to make an investment because we believe that this is a critical program for education and for health of our nation. Our partners are put out there. They've really supported our work extremely well, and I've already spoken very much about the best practice in terms of collaboration. We would like to say that, in conclusion, we believe that we have made huge strides since 2010 to implement this program with success. We are developing a strategy that will take us to full coverage for all learners in 5 years, and the two ministers have asked us to do that, so that as a country we can put on the table what are the resource commitments that the country must make if we believe that this program is an essential one and important one that we need to see to full achievement. Because we feel that this is a mechanism to deliver on outcome 1 and 2 of government and make sure that we deliver a quality basic education. Finally, some of our plans and what we're doing at the national level are not seeing full expression in schools, and we acknowledge that. And we feel that it is important in us that we are able to get tests also through this committee and the experiences from the ground level, some of those shortcomings, because we might set targets at the national level that are informed by provinces, but sometimes the shortcomings do not come to us. And that we feel that it's really important for us to get society and the support of the committee to point to us where the things that we're putting at the policy and the program level are not really finding full expression on the ground, because we need to fix that so that our policy and policies find expression, because ultimately that's where it's going to make a difference. Not what we put on paper, but what the child experiences with the school. And with that, we'd like to thank you very much and apologies for being a bit long-winded.
Thank you, Bob. That is the presentation from the department. We had two presentations, and I remember we have only 15 minutes that is left for us.
because we have a committee that starts at 12:30. I want you to be as short as possible, but stick to the point. Stick to the point that you want to speak to, and be as short as possible, please. Members. You raise your hand. You did not raise your hand.
No.
So thanks.
Now, thanks, Chairperson. The first question, thanks for the presentation. The first question would be the emergence, not even emergence, there is satanism in school. And last week was the worst case. I've had a reverend in Soweto saying that trying to now pray and all those things. What do you think you can come up with? I'm also staying at Inner Day. It's a current area. Also, satanism is very rife. So what is your plan? I know it's religion is free, but the satanism, I don't know whether it falls under the constitution. Today we woke up with a case of a 9-year-old having hanged himself in the class in front of the other learners. It's alleged it's through the butler of a window. And also schools cannot stay without butlers because the community comes in and do burglaries at school. It's just a challenge that you are faced with. The other thing is on the use of media. The more media is exposing this, it's like it's perpetuating, because others, like those that were beating up teachers last year, this week it was another one beating a teacher in a school with a broom. The following week it was the same thing in Gauteng. So I'm not sure maybe whether you need to engage with the media, though it is news to them. But there's an unintended consequence. Lastly, you have booklets. We also are having constituencies, which, I mean, like I'm saying, my era is very rife on these things. How do we get this information? And also ourselves, this committee, to know the contents of those booklets. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Delia. We look impressed by the lecture speaker and
listening very, very well to your question. Excuse me for running out again sometimes previously. It is in connection with the bills handling by the committees. I must assist there also. This person, in connection with violence in the schools, and also it relates to the help in schools. Now the implementation of the program must be very much focused, especially on the violence and the health. And it mustn't be for the schools exactly, for the learners and also for the teachers, just to come out of the class now and have a nice time where all the learners will sit somewhere in school, and then there's a presentation by either department or somebody else from the police or a community member or so on. Previously, that was actually the situation. It was very nice to come out of the class, and then we will have that situation. Now we're sitting there for an hour or two, and it shortens the time of the school. Can you just tell us what is the exact situation from your side in the schools in that relation? Is there a focused one where that presentation is actually going through the minds of the learners so that they can understand what is the plan? And then in connection with the toilet, Honorable Chairperson, the new one now, the toilets and the cleaning of material. And mostly when we were in provinces, we find out that the schools did have a problem with money ways to buy the cleaning materials to clean the toilets and also the classes. Now,
that situation is actually very worrisome for us. So if we want to be successful in this project, then we must see to that. And then the structure of the toilets also. You know, in the last province we went was Gauteng. The previous one was, I think, Mpumalanga. But at the school, it's still that old toilet structure where there's no window, just an opening somewhere there. And if you can stand up on somebody's back, you can look through and see what's happening inside. Now that situation must be addressed by the Department of Police and Education. We can't allow it anymore. Do you have a program, and can you supply us as members of this committee? Maybe it will be too late, but those who will be back, they can just use it, and when do this oversight, they can just check if the situation is solved. Now the structure is very, very good, it is very good to concentrate on the structure of the toilets also. And also the keeping, the cleanliness of the toilet pots. We did find a lot of problems. All the schools, not everyone, but all we went previously, we find that situation that there's a problem, especially in the toilet. Then at the school, the teacher did not or doesn't teach the learners to use a different towel. They wash their hands, and all of them use one towel. So that is not germ. That is carrying over the one germ to another one, and to another one, and to another one. It's actually best to use a paper. Every one of them use a paper, and the other one use a new paper, and so on. What is the situation from your side to address that problem? And then the chemistry material. Do you call it chemistry material for a girl?
Yes.
Yeah.
Keep it that way.
Yes.
Yeah.
That situation we still have a problem, especially in the rural schools, and where there's poverty among community. And I did get that information from the health department last time that they supply the schools and especially the girls with that. But we still got that problem at schools where some of those girls don't receive that. And what mechanism do you use to address it, where the packet actually go to the specific girl child? And it is not, I think it's embarrassing to some of them to go to a teacher and tell that teacher, I need that. There must be some kind of mechanism so that they can keep the dignity. And then in connection with the hair on the chair, because I'm very sorry to ask you, but it's important. The hair, the teeth, the nails, and the hands. Now, we must address. I've learned at the pre-primary school where my grandchild is, and I asked him what he actually do that. Now, he said to me, if there's one of the children arrives at the school and their hair is not combed, right? And sometimes he also don't want to comb his hair. Unbelievable. And at the school, he goes to the teacher and so that the teacher can do it. He don't want me to do it, he don't want to that his father wants to do it or his mother. But when in the school, then that is a different situation. And also the nails, some teachers, they forgot about the nails, the cleanliness and the cutting of the nails and the dressing of the nails and so on. Previously when we were at school, that was one of the most important things. In the morning especially, you must sit like this on the desk so that the teacher can check it. Your hands, your nails, and also your ear, your hair, and also the cleanliness of your ears and so on. What is the situation now currently from your side on that? Is it only come by giving them a booklet so that the teachers can read it, but what about the learners? Thank you.
Thanks, Honorable De Villiers. Hey, the next person happens is, you know, it is an Indian talent.
I changed my mind.
No, I just want to.
In fact, it was actually sparked by what said about this thing of satanism. Because I don't know how big a problem is it. Because this latest thing in from Soweto, it's not the first one. There were some cases in the recent past in Free State and so on and so on. How big the problem is.
Thank you, Honorable Members. Mine is very small. Maybe it's comments more than questions. You know, some of the violence that is happening, you already said it's happening outside schools, but it's happening within the children themselves. For example, the issue of last year when we visited a school here in Athlone, where a student was stabbed in the bus and killed in the school bus, instantly in the school bus, with all the other children inside the school. And it's not only high school students, it was primary and high school students that were in the bus. How do you describe that? Is that a school violence? Do you put it under school safety, or do you take it out from school safety because it's not happening at school? The you've got guiding principles that you worked on NDP as your action plan, goal 22. You know, this goal, it's so important for us, but it's on paper. The goal is on paper. In the reality of what is happening on the ground, some of the parents would love to be part of the governance of the school or participate in their school, but they don't know how to get in there. Because number one, the teachers will say to them, you as parents, ne? Don't get involved in what is happening in the school. This is our place as teachers. I remember when I was a teacher, I was once confronted by the issue of a teacher who has to be expelled from school. The parents wanted to take her out of the school, and the teacher said, no, I'm not employed by you. I am employed by the Department of Education, and that is true. But what that teacher was doing was not he was not doing it in the Department of Education. What he was doing that was wrong was in the parent and the children, in doing it in with the children. You see, the children were affected. That is why the community wanted him to be taken out of the Department of Education. But what I'm saying is the involvement of parents becomes so limited to the school. They want to participate, but how do we ensure that goal number 22, we see it alive in the schools? In model city schools, you can see it. But in our schools in rural areas and in our townships, you don't find it as it is found in the other schools. And also you have the current the in your slide that says current evidence on violence in schools, ne? You've got these participatory bodies that you have put in here. I would suggest in every body that is here, especially in our high schools, can't we also involve the children themselves so that we fight this crime in school or
we work on the school safety together with the children, because putting all these people's justice and constitutional development and whatever, it doesn't sound, it doesn't really, it's not felt in our schools. I said I'm just raising a concern. The issue of your key findings, you said educators were also victims of verbal violence in the school. You seem to be looking at a child attacking the educator only. I'm not sure if that is true. The child attacking the educator, not the educator attacking the child, or the child in sexual offenses. There are educators who also instigate a sexual offense to be done by the child, and if the child is not doing it the correct way, the educator will go to the police station or report the child to the principal because the child did not advance what the educator was expecting him or her to do to him, and that child will remain a victim forever in that school. I just want to check, how do you deal with that? And also the other challenge that we have in our schools, it's taverns that are around our schools. And there was a bill or whatever, something that was done for taking the taverns away from schools. But I'm from Jamestown, I was a teacher in Jamestown, and the tavern that I left there in 2009 is still next to the school. The other challenge that we have is graveyards that are next to the school. When I was a teacher, I'm saying this for the second time. When I was a teacher, during those years, the passing away of young parents leaving their 6-year-old and 7-year-old children behind, it affected them because they had to pass the graveyard where his or her mother has been buried on Saturday. On Monday morning when he goes or she goes to school, he or she must pass the graveyard. And it became so difficult that some others were so afraid to go to school, and they would run, if they have to pass the graveyard, they would run back home because they are afraid of that home where the mother or the father has been put in. I think also those challenges, they are disturbing the child mentally in the classroom, affecting the development of a child in the school. Those are things that, oh, the last one is the health. It's good that we have this we want this program back of nurses to visit schools. You know, I had a friend who was a nurse, but she passed away now. You know, she would come back from school, from visiting school, asibazele abantwana abanemfundo ezimnyama, abaneengcanca ezinkulu, abanentontontontoni ezithenitheniteni. And i-comment yakhe, she would not do it to us only. Uzothi xa ekhululisa a boy child in whatever place, the youth classroom, an empty classroom, and he would comment to that child that, yo unje, yo, and that is not followed up, and it also affects the child because the child was alone in that room with that nurse who made those comments to the children. I don't know, how are you going to change that attitude, because the attitude is within the character of the person, and it's not really known. The social inclusion and partnership, when was this established? Can we get a clarity on when was it established? Because the when I left education 2009, the violence in schools was very rife in Gauteng, and the focus was only if it happens in the school, then go there. Happens in school, then go there. But now it is as if it happens here, like I said with the media, it happens to the other, and you have a target. Are you having a phased-in approach target? Because even those that are quiet today, when they see these things, they do it. And then lastly, on the early detection, how does, I know with drugs, others you can see, but with the satanic challenges, maybe you need to go and research in terms of how can you detect that. When I was teaching, there was a 10-year boy who was also relating that they're flying in the evening, and the last night he said when they were flying.
the majority of the people that are making up this committee are ex-teachers. You'll forgive us about that. We are ex-teachers. Or former teachers. We're not ex out of school. We're former teachers. I'll give over to the department to give answers.
Thank you, Honorable Chair, and thank you, Honorable Members, for the questions. They really are important questions and areas that we have been working in. In terms of the Satanism issues, Honorable Member, it hasn't been, it flared up in certain areas. And when we've investigated into why this has happened, a lot of it happens because young girls, it's mainly young girls that are actually participating in this, is that young girls don't have any role models, so they see themselves as having these extra kind of powers, etc. So one of the things is that, like you said, the Constitution allows for whatever, you know, any religion, as long as it doesn't harm any other person. But where Satanism goes wrong is that it begins to harm not other persons only, but animals and etc. Yes. So, you know, that immediately becomes unconstitutional. We have a list of some of the areas that have been showing, some kind of interest in Satanism. And we did have that high-profile case where the young girl was burned alive by her friend by some kind of satanic act. And we see that also in terms of Satanism, there are certain programs on TV on witches and vampires, and so it's giving young people a kind of a magical thing or fantasy thing to think about. And I think what we need to do as a department is that those particular schools or areas that show that kind of increase and that is reported to us, because several times we don't know about it, but those that are reported to us is that we go into those schools and do a kind of rehabilitation where we pronounce on the Constitution that we are not saying that, you know, your particular religion, if that's what it is, but we also need to say that it goes against the Constitution when you do things like that. You take somebody else's life.
Mm-hmm.
You take the life of any animal, etc., as part of your ritual. You know, so those are some things that we will do. But we're also going to develop a pamphlet and put it up on the website, especially how schools should respond to issues of Satanism. And we're working with the South African Human Rights Commission on the pamphlet, because there's so many areas there that in terms of the legal rights of a child, we could get into trouble. So that is taking a bit of time to put that pamphlet together. And talking about the child hanging himself, again, through the burglar bars, I mean, this shows the need for psychosocial support in schools. And Dr. Kumalo will speak specifically to that. But many times the teachers I also was a teacher, so I can understand what you're saying. Many times, the teachers are so engrossed in doing the math and the science, and they don't realize that the child is actually suffering, that there is some kind of psychological damage. And I think it's important that we begin to express that more in terms of teacher training and teacher development. Mm-hmm. In some of the training that we are planning to have on gender-based violence, we're putting that as an integral part of the teacher's reflection, is that they must be vigilant for signs. Especially if a child's been abused, they'll act out in the classroom.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Or a vibrant child who's having some problems at home becomes quiet. I mean, I know that in my class. I used to teach a class of 56 learners. But I knew when something was up, when, you know, the child was quiet, mm-hmm. and something's not happening yet. And then you call them in, you give them some counseling, and then you can refer them. So it's up to teachers as well. I know it's quite a difficult thing in large classes and a lot of high workloads. But at the end of the day, we have human beings in our classroom, and we are human beings as well. So it's important to be vigilant. In terms of the booklet, we do have a lot of information here that Mahada has that we will give to you. But also, if you should need any more, we can make them available. Okay, so please let us know. If you go into a school and you need the information, please let us know so that we can make the information available. Honourable Member de Villiers, the question was about the toilets and hygiene, and that some of the toilets are not being cleaned. The norms and standards for school funding is part of the maintenance budget for schools. Give them that funding to fix the school if there's small, like, you know, window, and also for cleaning as well. So we need to look at how that particular school is utilizing that funding, you know, and whether they are able to provide the kind of materials needed for cleaning. And also the old structure, there is now the minimum, the norms and standards for school infrastructure that speaks specifically to issues of ablution facilities, including toilets. And I think, you know, as it only came out in November last year, so it would be important for schools themselves to begin to look at it and then raise it at the level of district and go up to the provinces so that these schools are put onto the priority list to get those toilets sorted out. Teaching hygiene, I agree. I mean, we used to have also health education when I was a child, and it's sure that you wash your hands, and there is something like that in the life orientation curriculum, but Dr. Kumalo will speak to that. The sanitary towels is a serious problem in some rural areas. We have many campaigns like the Dignity campaign, Dignity for Girls campaign that is being run by the Department of Women, Children and People with Disabilities. But they're not able to reach all the schools. Also, you know, in the rural areas, they have the pit latrine. So they create another problem is that the young girls throw the sanitary towels into the pit latrine. They're not biodegradable. Then there's no waste management in terms of clogs up the pit latrine. So I know I've been in discussion with the Department of Women, Children and People with Disabilities to come up with a far more eco-friendly you know, sanitary towels so that we don't go and clog up the pit latrines as well. And yes, you know, the thing is, where there are no sanitary towels, girls stay away from it.
Yeah.
You know, and where there's no toilets as well. So their human dignity is obviously, you know, being violated. And it is an area that we are looking into, working with partners, but it is the Department for Women, Children and People with Disabilities that's taking it forward. But safe to say, we have a partnership with Procter & Gamble, and that partnership is with us as the Department of Basic Education. And wherever it's been brought to our attention that those children need sanitary towels, we have been able to provide them with it. And if you have identified another area, please let us know so we can see how Procter & Gamble can support that school. Okay, Honourable Chairperson, you asked about, yes, violence in school is something for us to deal with, but it doesn't mean if a child gets killed outside the gate that it's not our issue as well.
Mm-hmm.
And being killed in the school bus as well, it is our issue. You know, the thing is, many times we find that the school schools don't listen to the intelligence that other kids can give them. And, they, and that, that is a skill that you need to have as a principal and as a teacher as well. Because they know when somebody has broken guns to school or has broken knives to school. And I think, you know, we need to empower our teachers to be more vigilant to the intelligence that comes out of the young learners themselves. Because the school should have known in the morning that somebody was carrying a knife to school, you know, and especially in a school that is has high levels of violence. I mean, they must.
So remember, this in this incident, they were still going to school.
Oh, it was
in school
the morning.
In the morning.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay, all right. Honourable Chairperson, as much as I'd love to say that we must know everything, you know, those few things happen, but at the same time, I think it's important for us, not just our children to, you know, sort of spy on the other children, but for them to understand how important it is, how important human life is, and if somebody's life is in danger, they must speak up. They must tell the teacher. Yes, they can tell the prefect. They don't, if they're so afraid, they can tell the prefect or somebody that this child has a gun. In one instance, the child brought the gun 5 times to the school before he shot somebody. So he was, and the kids knew. So it's about how the learners themselves become part of the protective system of the school. And I think that is something that's important. But something we need to look at, and you've actually exposed it, is that the bus driver and the conductor as well need to be a bit vigilant. I'm sure this is a school bus or was it a private?
I think it's a school bus because it's a bus that is taking, transporting learners to the community school. Yes.
Okay, because I think we also need to have a partnership with these, with the bus company to say that the Sipao children is there, please ensure that there is a conductor or somebody in that bus, an adult supervising. Because if you're leaving the kids there, you've got little kids and you've got adults, there's a lot of harassment happens in the buses like in the taxi. So it's important if we can, that is an area that we will definitely look into. You spoke about the figures I put on the slide and the fact that I didn't highlight that educators are sometimes the perpetrators of violence in schools. And yes, I didn't. There are definitely evidence in terms of that. But we've been working very closely with the South African Council of Educators to be able to deal with these issues. And I think, you know, for too long, things have gone on as they have been going on. But I think our kids are becoming far more vigilant, far more open, and they have been talking about it. So an educator knows now. I mean, I was in the car and I heard this advert for the Western Cape Department about a young girl and a teacher, and the teacher likes the young girl, and she says, no, you are my teacher, you're not supposed to be thinking about me like that. And it was an interesting thing. And I think an important part of our school safety and life orientation is to impress upon young people about their rights as well. That, you know, the teacher has no right to do these things. And also working with the teacher unions and with SAFE to ensure that, you know, that the rights of the child are actually honored. And that the teacher, even if the child looks like she's 18 or 19, that, you know, she's not available in that sense. And I think we need to be more, this is what we're discussing with SAFE, is that there needs to be more advocacy from the side of SAFE. Mm-hmm. And more, only 22 cases came in last year. It's such a process of teacher-learner sexual relationships. And according to the legal, if the child is 17, 18, and is consensual, it becomes a bit difficult. But now the law is quite clear. And SAFE is making it quite clear as well that the teacher must be struck off the list. And it's statutory rape. If the child is below 16 years old, the Sexual Offences Act says it's statutory rape, and we must follow through on the criminal issues as well. You spoke about learner's voice. We don't use learner's voice. We certainly do. We have dialogues, the GMBM dialogue, the community dialogue, where young people, an intergenerational dialogue, where young people talk about what they are afraid of, and they'll tell you about their teachers as well, you know, and they talk about what happens in their home. So there, the information we get out of these dialogues influences the type of programs we have. So yes, we do have child participation. We also, I wanted to show you this. This is a postcard we give to schools where we're running school safety programs in the school, and each learner has to fill this in.
Okay.
Then we analyze their responses so that we can give them a targeted response to their needs. It's not just a generic thing, but something that responds to the needs they need. Thank you. I hope I've answered all the questions.
Okay.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'd like to start where Dr. Mana ended, you know, to indicate, for instance, that we ran a competition for secondary school learners for them to provide us information in terms of the HIV and AIDS life skills program. So it was also a postcard competition, and we asked them, you know, what works, but also more importantly, what doesn't work and what recommendations they have. And so we use that information to guide what then becomes the focus of the program. And I think members would be interested to know that, you know, one of the things that came from learners themselves was that they wanted a lot more attention on boys and boys' issues. That it seems very much as a girl-centered world, and we're focusing, you know, programs around that, but that there are boys who are struggling and they also want to be spoken to, as well as those that, you know, lesbian, gay, bisexual, you know, LGBTI, intersex, and queer groups, that they also said they have some issues. So we try to integrate that into the program. I wanted to just add information in terms of, you know, hygiene and hand washing that Honorable Zedin has raised. It is such an important topic that you raised, and it's something that we really are doing. It probably didn't come out in the presentation. It's part of the health education component that we want the health promoters to really address, because it's something we had, and it's something that is relatively cheap, but it has a major, major influence in terms of the health outcome. And we are working with many companies, including Colgate Palmolive, to make sure that we also have soap available, because while water is also is important in itself, but the soap aspect must come into it as well, to make sure that it's soap and water. And so we celebrate every year with the partners International Hand Washing Day to make sure that we bring the profile around that issue. But I think we raised very much with us that we also need to make sure that teachers are also involved and check up on these things. I want just to end up with just acknowledging a few things that members have raised with us. The issue around the materials. Honorable, you mentioned, you know, we have a lot of materials that we're developing, and I think we're not really successful in making sure that they get out there as much as they should. And we've taken that to make sure that we'll provide, after this meeting, a lot of the materials that we also have around health, and that they are available to you. I want to indicate also that the information is also available on our website, and we've uploaded a portion of this material, and we can make the information ready available to our office here. We take the point. I think everything said and done is really not helpful if we have all these wonderful resources and we don't find ways to get them. So engaging the media, trying a little bit more, and working with the community and others, I think we can only succeed. We've also been asked about the plan around infrastructure specifically. It's not a mandate that's restricted, so we will go back, Honorable De Villiers, and try and find that out from the responsible branch and make sure that we provide it to the committee. And really just finally, around the targets around schools, Honorable Chairperson, is that there is an interministerial committee that runs with drug and alcohol use, and in fact there's a process underway to look exactly at that component around the number, but also the proximity of taverns to school as well as to places of worship. And I think that committee decided to prioritize the issue on
alcohol advertising first, but certainly the issue around the proximity and how many licenses will come on the radar very, very soon. And we're working, and that committee also works very closely with the department COPTA, because it's a municipal competence to issue out licenses. So when we do that, we have to consider all those things. And the department participates in those forums, and I think that's why we are aware of that, and are also bringing the issues of schools right to the fore. That was my, that's the only additions. I think the chairperson indicated we haven't addressed any of the issues. I think many of them are comments, and we've noted them, and we will make sure that we engage. But there's two commitments about what we will provide afterwards. We've noted and we shall be.
Thanks, honorable members, and thanks to the department for the comprehensive presentation that you gave us. We will look upon you if we see there is anything that is happening that is not happening on the ground that is supposed to be happening. We will call upon the department to intervene. And also the cases of the children that are being victimized at school, the follow-ups that are being done by the Department of Education on how to deal with, for example, the parents of a child who went to school and be killed on the way to school, the trauma that is within that family, how to deal with it, the economic issues, because some of the things that are happening to these children is because of the economic issue around that. The pamphlet you are speaking about, we can have a website, we can have pamphlets, but how do we get those pamphlets to Kodala, to Kaukein, to Nkanduli, and all those areas? How do we get them to find expression in those areas? And also the issue, Honorable de Villiers was talking about, of the towels, to when you wash it. It's not necessary for us, because in my area, if you go to a funeral, you come back, we wash our hands. But if we wash our hands, we don't dry them with towel. We let our hands dry themselves. The natural means to dry our hands. That is, if we've got soap and enough water, if the department can check on that, we have enough water in our schools, we've got a little bit of soap for them to wash their hands. They can dry their hands while they are going to the classroom. When they get to the classroom, their hands are already dried. But Papa, thank you very much for everybody that is in this room. The meeting stands adjourned.
Okay. Thank you for the good.